Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 10 this morning. He says, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city, which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. I don't know that we really get what's going on here in this text. I want you to think about being Abraham for a minute. And think about what the implications of this would be. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. He left. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob. He had sons, and they grew up in these tents. The first mobile home, maybe, I don't know. And they were the heirs of him, with him of the same promise. And he waited for the city, which, by the way, never came, whose builder and maker is God. You see what's going on here? We meet Abraham, and we see several identities in these verses. In fact, there are three main identities, ways that we can identify Abraham. One in verse 8, one in verse 9, and one in verse 10. In verse 8, we see Abraham the wanderer, okay? The wanderer. I want you to notice a couple things about his wandering. First of all, notice it says at the beginning of verse 8, by faith Abraham obeyed. And we've been talking about the fact that in Hebrews, it is about faith and obedience. We often call it the great hall of faith. It's really the great hall of obedience. Obedience that never would have taken place if there had not been faith first. If we read the story of Abraham, which we're not going to take the time this morning to go back and do that, if we continue in this text and in the future days, and we'll take some time to look at where the author is drawing these things from Abraham's life. But if we read Genesis 15:6, it says Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. But then we come to Genesis 26, verse 5, and it says, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Abraham is an example to us both of faith and obedience. And so he begins to wander. I want you to know, notice also that it says he went to a place that he was promised. He would receive it as an inheritance, verse 8. And then in verse 9, it talks about the land of promise and Jacob and Isaac being the heirs of that promise. And from then on, Abraham lived his whole life, okay? His whole life in light of that promise that he never received, by the way. Not in this life, he did not. He's living the rest of his life and making all of his decisions and going from place to place in light of this promise. It's a very unique thing. He never saw the nation that he was promised. God told him in Genesis 12:1, get out of Ur, which was the big empire back then. For all we know, Abram was a pagan in Ur, that God graciously chose and grabbed him out of Ur and said, look, I'm going to make of you a great nation. Walk before me and be perfect, God said to him later on. So he changed Abraham and brought him out of Ur and said, take your family and go. He left, I'm sure, a nice dwelling in a wonderful city with whatever technology they had. There is amazing things they did have in the ancient world, and I'm sure they would have had them in Ur or in Egypt, one of those two places. So he leaves this place. He never had the city that it talks about here. He always lived in hope, and he died in hope. He lived all the time for what only was in his imagination. When I first defined faith weeks ago when we started getting into Hebrews chapter 11, remember I said that faith functions in the realm of that which we cannot see, which is in our imagination. We're used to using the word imagination as something that's just make-believe. Imagination is only make-believe if you have the wrong things in there. God tells us what is real that we cannot see, and when we embrace it as if it really is, that is what faith is. Faith functions in the realm of that which we cannot see, in the realm of that which is promised but not yet obtained, and then the realm of that which is present but not observed. And so Abraham begins to function this way. And notice also in verse 8 that he goes out not knowing where he was going. And we do this sometimes. I love living in the mountains because every once in a great while, and it hasn't happened in a while, I wish it has, but we just haven't had a lot of time to just go off driving different places. But sometimes I'll look way off in the distance and I'll say, now there's a mountain peak. I'm just going to, without a map, try to figure out how to get over there. And usually we get sidetracked along the way before we actually reach the destination. But we do that. We wander. And, you know, sometimes we've gotten lost. But it's not a bad thing as long as you got a full tank of gas. Eventually you can find somebody to ask where the road is and get back to it. Now that we all have GPS, you know, it's not as fun anymore. But we go out and we wander different places. Okay, but this is not like that, okay? In fact, even if you can imagine right now just taking your family, getting up and just going somewhere, you might imagine going somewhere else in the United States. Well, that's still pretty safe. You might say, well, we're going to go to a foreign country, Canada, you know. You know, you could still get along in Canada. I've been in Mexico quite a while, and, you know, we get along pretty well there. Maybe you can think of just a real foreign country where we just feel lost, like maybe Dubai. No, I'm just kidding. Or, you know, some place that would just be completely foreign to you. South Florida, okay. I was going to mention Oklahoma, but I'm trying to get us to stretch just a little bit more. But you know what I'm saying? Go picking up and moving somewhere now, and also realize you're moving to a place where in Palestine you have these little Palestinian Canaanite city states. There wasn't a stable government. You're just going somewhere. The world is totally a different place than it is right now, back then. And Abraham is picking up and he's going with his stuff and his family, and he's never coming back. He's a wanderer. A wanderer is one who cannot find a permanent place. Right? I mean, I hope it's starting to sink in a little bit what Abraham is doing here. It's nuts, except that he has faith in God. So we see Abraham the wanderer. Secondly, we see Abraham the foreigner. Abraham the foreigner. Because in verse 9, it says he dwelt by faith in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. He goes to a different land. I don't know. A lot of you probably have been to different countries, or you've gotten into places like maybe South Florida or places where you totally feel out of place. Everybody's speaking a different language. Angie probably shared a little bit of this after Sunday school today, or after our Sunday school prayer hour. Being in a place where she didn't really speak French well and they didn't really speak English well, that had to be very unnerving. And it's not only just the language. When we were in Australia years ago, you feel like they speak English, so the culture's just the same. Well, it's not just the same. And in fact, you don't notice exactly how different the culture is at first. It sort of takes you by surprise. In the fact that people don't get you or understand what you're saying as much as they do in the States. And so you start feeling a little out of place. You're in a totally different place with totally different customs. You're in a place where you have no rights if you're in a foreign country. You don't have the same rights. Two young men, Shane Bauer and Josh Flattle, have found this out. They're the hikers that were arrested by the Iranian government and apparently were sentenced to 8 years in prison this weekend. And the whole United States apparently can't get these two boys out of the custody of Iran, and everybody knows they didn't even do anything. But they're in a foreign country. They're at the mercy of that government. They're out of place. They don't feel right. Have you ever felt out of place like that? Maybe in a foreign country, maybe going to a new school, maybe to a new social setting. You're not accepted, perhaps. It's awkward. You're the outsider. There's a conversation going on, but when you walk over to it, it sort of dies away because you're not part of it, and they know it, and so they don't talk like they would if they knew you very well. But if things are going well, if you start being adjusted to that place and you start getting to know people, then we say things like, well, now I feel right at what? Home. Yes, exactly. Abraham's a foreigner. He's a wanderer and a foreigner. And thirdly, he's a sojourner. He's a sojourner. Somebody says, that's kind of like a wanderer. Well, there's a difference between a sojourner and a wanderer. A wanderer just refers to the activity of going from place to place, not having a home. But a sojourner is a special kind of wanderer. A sojourner is a person who's wandering, but he's on his way to another place. He's just passing through, but there is an ultimate destination. He's not at home. He's in a strange land, but he's getting somewhere eventually. Why? Look at verse 10. Because it says here that Abraham waited for the city, which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. I want to work backwards through that verse for just a second. It says the builder and maker is God. God himself will provide this city, this place of residency. Normally a builder builds something and we attribute the building to him or the monument to him, but oftentimes he hired subcontractors or people to help do the actual work. Here in the verbiage, the language of the text, it is God who is doing the actual building. God is preparing this place, the verse says. It reminds me of what Jesus says to his disciples, I go to prepare a place for you. God himself prepares the dwelling for his people. And secondly, it says that this dwelling place that God will build is a city which has foundations. Now, there's no city that is spoken of specifically in Genesis 12 and following when God calls Abraham out. He says, I will build you a great nation. Maybe a city is implied there. But the idea here, and the reason the author is using a city in particular, is because he's talking about Abraham dwelling in tents. And you know what tenting is like. We've been camping a little bit with some of the families here at this church and over the years. And some of you have done maybe great camp outings. And you know you tent, and the wind can blow the tent. You can pull up the stakes. You can move the tent. The comparison to that, or the contrast, I should say, is that God is preparing for Abraham a permanent place that has foundations. It's not going anywhere. Once he moves to this place, he's put for good. And that's the difference in why he uses this idea of a permanent city. Maybe it's an allusion to the New Jerusalem. I'm not sure. It doesn't necessarily have to be that. The idea is a permanency as opposed to wandering around. So God is establishing a permanent place. And last, in verse 10, it says that Abraham waited for that city. Okay, there was never a time in his life where he was not waiting for the city. Never. He never reached his ultimate destination. He was always sort of getting there. He was called to believe it was coming. And as Hebrews will tell us later on in the chapter, many of you know who read Hebrews chapter 11, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises. He was called to leave his city, to be a wanderer and a foreigner. And back in the city, at least there was security. It was responsible. He probably had a house. If he had been alive today, he might have had a nice lawn, you know, that he took care of. And he had maybe a two-car garage and a couple of cars to go in them. I don't know. They didn't have middle class back then. He's probably richer than normal. He had servants. He could pick up his house and leave. So maybe he would have had a bigger dwelling. But it was safe. It was sensible for him to be in Ur, but instead he wandered the rest of his life lifting a tent flap to go indoors, being able to pull up his house and move it. And he's a foreigner, feeling the sting and the oddity of being in a strange place. Tell them you're my sister, he says to Sarai. You know, they'll kill me if they see how beautiful you are. Going into Egypt, the strange place, not knowing what was going to happen to him. He thought he might be killed. Being uncomfortable. But he was a sojourner, always yearning for a place called home that was promised but not obtained. In fact, in verse 10, where it says he waited for the city, this is an intensified verb. Literally, we could say he waited expectantly or he waited eagerly for the city. A wanderer, a foreigner, and a sojourner. Now, I cannot think of a more comprehensive text that describes exactly who we are as God's people than this text. We are wandering in this world. We really are. Because this is not our true homeland. If we're living by faith, it's not. Philippians 3 says that our citizenship is in heaven. The place we really belong, the place that is really our home, it's not here. We're wanderers. And because this is not our homeland, we're foreigners. We don't really get the language of the culture. At least we don't when we live by faith. We don't understand all the customs. Their values are not our values. Sometimes they're odd to us, and we to them. We don't get each other totally. But we're also sojourners because we long for a better place, a heavenly place, the new heaven and the new earth ultimately in the resurrection body. We long for that with eagerness, with expectancy. Or do we long for that? That's what the author is asking us. Do we feel unsettled about where we live? Do we feel odd? Do we feel sometimes out of place? Do we not feel like we're in the crowd? You know what I'm saying? We're not totally accepted. Do we sometimes feel out of the loop? I don't mean that we need to be aloof to what's going on in the world and aloof to people. That's not any good. That's not being salt and light on this earth. There's no virtue in being ignorant about the world and what's going on. But do we feel detached from that like we should? Like it's not really us. It's not really where we're going. It's not really what we value. Because this is how a believer feels. I want you to turn for a second to Jeremiah chapter 29. Jeremiah chapter 29. I want to make a particular point by reading something that would be very interesting to you. In Jeremiah chapter 29, we have this letter that Jeremiah sends to the captives who are in Babylon. Now, you have to remember, in 605, Nebuchadnezzar came with an army and surrounded Jerusalem and seized it, took it over, set up who he wanted to be king. Egypt had just done this, so they were starting to get used to it. And he leaves and leaves Jerusalem intact and leaves a king on the throne. Eventually, he rebels, and so the king rebels, so Nebuchadnezzar comes back and does it again. And finally, in 586, Nebuchadnezzar says, I'm tired of coming back across the desert. That's it. So he totally destroys Jerusalem, destroys the temple. It's God's judgment upon them for their sin. But Jeremiah is still there after the first wave of attack. And so a lot of the people, Jeconiah the king, and a lot of the people, Daniel, for instance, and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they're all back now in Babylon. They were transported. So Jeremiah writes a letter to them to try to tell them how to behave in the new land. He tells them, settle down, make yourselves homes there, be faithful to God. God did this because of our sin against him. Just live with it, be faithful to him. God promises to bring us back someday. He writes this letter to them, okay? Now, I call your attention to this letter because so often in the ancient world, other documents would appear that are not scripture, but based on stories and accounts that are told in the Bible. There's this ancient letter that was written supposedly from Jeremiah to the captives in Babylon. Now, we know this letter specifically was written around 100 BC. So we're about 400 years removed, 400 or 500 years removed from when this event actually happened. But you see what was going on when this letter, I'm going to read you a part of it. What was going on when this letter occurred is that God's people, the Jews, who were still waiting for their Messiah in about 150 BC to 100 BC, they were being pummeled by the people groups around them, the Syrians, for instance, who had come in and tried to desecrate their temple, and they had to take it back over. And there were Jews scattered throughout the world. They were living in Babylon. They were living in Assyria. They were living in Syria. They were living down in Egypt. And they're surrounded by pagan peoples who are worshiping false gods. And there were many faithful Jews, and some of them wrote these documents, and because they wanted them to be read, they would say that they were from somebody great, like Jeremiah. We know that's not from Jeremiah. In fact, it's not even the same time period of Jeremiah. But I want you to hear the author's concern of this letter. He wants the Jewish people to be faithful to God and not follow idols, the idols of the culture. And so he mocks the idols in this letter. Now he says to them, because of the sins that you have committed before God, you will be taken to Babylon as exiles by Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians. That's a safe prophecy since it happened 300 or 400 years earlier. Therefore, when you have come to Babylon, you will remain there for many years, for a long time, up to 7 generations. Now he got that wrong because it was supposed to be 70 years. But he says 7 generations. After that, I will bring you away from there in peace. Now in Babylon, you will see gods made of silver and gold and wood, which people carry on their shoulders, and which cause the heathen to fear. So beware of becoming at all like the foreigners, or of letting fear for these gods possess you when you see the multitude before and behind them worshiping them. But say in your heart, it is you, O Lord, whom we must worship. Their tongues, that is the tongues of these idols as their carved images, their tongues are smoothed by the carpenter. And they themselves are overlaid with gold and silver. But they are false and cannot speak. People take gold and make crowns for their heads of their gods, as they might for a girl who loves ornaments. Sometimes the priests secretly take gold and silver from their gods and spend it on themselves. They deck their gods out with garments like human beings, these gods of silver and gold and wood that cannot save themselves from rust or corrosion. When they have been dressed in purple robes, their faces are wiped because of the dust from the temple, which is thick upon them. They have to dust off their gods. One of them holds a scepter like a district judge, but is unable to destroy anyone who offends it. Another has a dagger in his right hand and an axe, but cannot defend itself from war and robbers. For this is evident that they are not gods, so do not fear them. For just as someone's dish is useless when it is broken, so are the gods when they have been set up in the temples. Their eyes are full of the dust raised by the feet of those who enter to worship them. And just as the gates are shut on every side against anyone who has offended a king, as though under sentence of death, so the priests make their temples secure with doors and locks and bars in order that they might not be plundered by robbers. They light more lamps for them than they light for themselves, though their gods can see none of them. They are just like a beam of the temple. But their hearts, it is said, are eaten away when crawling creatures from the earth devour them and their robes. They do not notice when their faces have been blackened by the smoke in the temple. Bats, swallows, birds light on their bodies and heads, and so do cats. I don't know why cats, but cats is in here. From this you will know that they are not gods, so do not fear them. As for their gold that they wear for beauty, it will not shine unless someone wipes off the tarnish. For even when they were being cast, they did not feel it. They are bought without regard to cost, but there is no breath in them. Having no feet, they are carried on the shoulders of others, revealing to humankind their worthlessness, and those who serve them are put to shame, because if any of these false gods falls to the ground, they themselves must pick it up. If anyone sets it upright, it cannot move itself, and if it is tipped over, it cannot straighten itself. They are made by carpenters and goldsmiths. They can be nothing but what an artisan wishes them to be. Those who make them will certainly not live very long themselves. How can these things that are made by them be gods? They have left only lies and reproach for those who come after. For when war or calamity comes upon them, the priests consult together as where to they can hide themselves and their gods. How then can one fail to see that these are not gods? For they cannot save themselves from war or calamity. Since they are made of wood and overlaid with gold and silver, it will afterward be known that they are false. It will be manifest to all the nations and kings that they are not gods, but the work of human hands, and that there is no work of God in them. Who then can fail to know that these are not gods? Now, the author here, of course, is warning his people about assimilation. You know what assimilation is? Assimilation is when a minority people group gets swallowed up by a majority people group. Okay? Do you understand that? Assimilation, cultural assimilation, is when a minority people group starts being swallowed up by taking on the customs of and the language of and the dress of and the habits of and the standards of the larger group. They sort of get swallowed in so you can't distinguish the minority group any longer. Jesus Christ told the crowds that wide is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be which go in. But very narrow is the way which leads to life, and few there be that find it. The truth is, God's people are always in the minority. And so there is always a danger of cultural assimilation. We pick up the habits of the culture and the language of the culture and the values of the culture. We laugh at these people with their gods. You can imagine these people worshiping these gods. They're imagining something that is going on that's false. This is make-believe. They're putting their whole life and they're giving their money and time and energy to these gods that have to be carried around on their shoulders, that they have to dust off and keep clean. They are no gods. We laugh at them. But we have our hearts set on things that do not rescue us either. We want our power and our prestige and our possessions. We've got our minds set on something, and we're going to get it in the future. Prominence, popularity, performance, pleasure, prosperity. And we have our hearts set on these things. We work for money to have a home and a good retirement so we can take it easy. A lot of people are like that. That's really all they're living for. That is the essence of worldliness. Worldliness is not necessarily violating these standards over here that are Christian standards. Worldliness is living for this world as if everything that matters is right here. That's what worldliness is. Nothing wrong with working really hard, having a home, or any of those things. Oftentimes they represent God's blessing and faithfulness in our lives. But if that is all it is what is here, and there's nothing beyond that, they are idols and gods. They are taking the place of what really is going on, which we ought to be thinking of in our imagination that God is telling us about in his word and acting on it. We want to explore our talents and develop them. And so we practice or work or go to school and do all these things as if that is all there is, if I can just get good at something. We have our eyes on cars and education and houses. We have noise all around us. When you get in the car, you have to turn the radio on because the silence is just sort of deafening. I mean, you can't not have noise around. I mean, if there's quiet, you start thinking about your life and things that maybe matter. And sometimes we don't like that. So we turn on the radio when we get in the car. We have our ears plugged in. We have a generation now where we never have to be unplugged. And then if that's not enough, we go shopping and start spending money to fill in some kind of void or gap that we have in our hearts, because we are not really in faith grabbing onto what is real. We're grabbing onto false, and we look just as ridiculous with our hearts set on these things which will burn up someday as these ancients who carve out their idols and bow to them as if there's something to them. This is the essence of worldliness. We're not wandering. We feel like we've arrived. We're not foreigners. We feel right at home. We're not sojourners, because all we think about is what is here and the implications of what is going on in this life. But what this earth has to offer can never satisfy us. It can never save us. It can never redeem us. So how do I live so that I am not consumed by these things? The answer is right in Hebrews 11. We live by faith. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, what God has promised us but has not yet been obtained. Do we live thinking about that place that we will someday inhabit? I want you to turn, lastly, as I finish here, to Revelation chapter 21, just for a few moments. Revelation 21. We really should read all two chapters, the last two chapters of the scripture, where God opens up the curtain for us and shows us what is to come. It's a wonderful thing to read this from time to time. But for our time's sake this morning, just the first couple of verses of Revelation 21. Okay, realize when we read this, this is where we're headed. But this is our goal. This is our hope. It's the only thing that makes everything that's going on mean something. Revelation 21. I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth has passed away, and there was no more sea. Now, let me insert something here. We don't take away from this the fact that we don't have value in this earth right now. We are called to be salt and light and to minister to this earth. It's not that we just say, forget the whole earth, we're just all we're going to do is sit around and think about this. No, our walk from day to day on this earth is in light of this that is coming. It fuels and informs everything that we do in our ministry and in our church and in our family. So he says in verse 2, I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Then he who sat on his throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Later on in this passage, we're not going to take time to read it, but he talks about this city. And it's interesting that he says the city, in verse 14, had 12 foundations. And on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Do you believe, really, that this is where we're headed? That this is where we're going? That what we see down here right now is just a shadow? Just a temporary breath compared to the eternity that awaits us? Are we simply wandering right now and interpreting everything we see with the attitude that, you know, I can do something here, I can accomplish something here, I can glorify the Lord here, but this is not where I really belong. I am waiting for something more permanent, something eternal, something glorious. Is this the way we feel? Is this world our home? Or are we sojourners waiting for another home? If God allows, my plan, which has not wavered at all, is just, I recognize God's will and sometimes his sovereignty. My plan is to be back here in the course of 2 years or a little less than that when the work is over at Southeastern. But I've always thought from the very beginning when this idea came into my brain, this mad idea, when I come back to Bethany, I want it to be the same Bethany. I'm not naive about that. I mean, we grow and change, and I really shouldn't say I want it to be the same Bethany. I want it to be Bethany where we're closer to the Lord than we are right now, and that God has done other things that are wonderful that we never expected. That's what we should really hope for. But you know what I mean? I mean, I love the fact that we have a body of people who love the Lord, and they really do love each other, and we are waiting for the Lord to return. This is not a unique idea to any of you. These are reminders to us that we need all the time not to get focused upon what is on this earth. But how are we going to be the same church in the sense of trusting the Lord and growing in him and having God work through us and work in us? How are we going to be that church? in the generations to come. It is by keeping our affection on things above, like it says in Colossians 3, not on things on the earth. Keeping our affections on those things. Not just knowing that the Bible says they're going to come someday as sort of an idea I have in my head. It's my affection. My love for these things is here. And so I interpret what I see in light of what God has promised. That's how we live by faith. So I don't maybe end up with all the prestige I thought of when I was younger. I'm not as popular, perhaps, when I end up living my life on this earth for God. And maybe I don't get the pleasure that I once contemplated. Maybe I'm not as prosperous. Maybe I don't have that possession, that thing that I wanted when I was younger. Maybe I finally come to a point where I say, well, you know, maybe the Lord isn't going to give that to me. Maybe I don't have as much prominence. Maybe I don't have that promotion. But if we're able to say, but I have known God, that is what matters. And that's what will propel us forward to live for him and to do his will on this earth. So let us rejoice in the fact that this is not all there is. But let's live and make decisions and love what we should love and hate what we should hate in light of what God is doing. And may God have the glory for all those things that he will do as we walk by faith. Father, thank you for this wonderful example of Abraham, who in his life did something physically, socially, that represents exactly what we're going through as believers on this earth. He wandered. Father, I'm afraid so often we feel right at home here as if we could live here forever and it would be okay. There's not that sense of interruption, that sense of being off kilter a little bit, that sense of being a little bit odd, or that sense of just longing for something that we don't have right now. I pray that it would be so. I pray that we would start to feel as believers how we would feel if we actually uprooted and went to a place not knowing what was going to happen to us. But Father, the difference is, and we praise you for it, that you have told us exactly what is going to happen, and you've given us your promise, and we trust in that. We cling to it. So we are not just wanderers and not just foreigners. We are sojourners. We are waiting for that country, waiting for that city that has foundations that will stay, where we will feel completely at home forever in your presence. Father, in the meantime, may we yearn to know you and to prepare our hearts for that time. Do this for us by faith, because we trust in you for this rich blessing in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.